Political Science and Director of Forensics at Spelman College in Atlanta. Dr. Rotmoff most recently was on a violence project with the Morehouse School of Medicine, and he is also a co-founder of the Atlanta Urban Debate League.
And thank you, Senator, for offering me this opportunity to make some comments. I was very taken by the fact that I'm listed as making reflections, because that means I have no specific responsibilities and kind of wax poetic. The other things I need to make you aware of as we begin, first of all, I'm uniquely aware of the fact that I am sandwiched between two giants in the field of collegiate debate. On the one hand, we have Dr. Snyder, who's been doing this an awful long time and very well, as evidenced by the results of the students. And on the other hand, the other side of me, is Melissa Wade, who is the queen mother of this activity. I'm not even a professor of linguistics or communications. I'm a humble political science professor who stands before you armed only with the truth. So it seems to me that there is some equity about the fact that I would be put here in this position between the two. I think it probably is also not coincidental that they began this rattling stuff back here when it was time for me to make my comments. But I'm going to adjust to all of that and make the comments that I intend to make under the title of Reflection. At this stage of the game, I should also say that I'm always remindful of the fact that I'm here because there are an awful lot of students who believe in some things that we started, who took it upon themselves to go out and slay a lot of dragons that we thought we could slay, who actually took the fight to the battlefield and did the things that we imagined were possible. And if it were not for those people, then persons like myself would not be here addressing you, indicating that these things are possible. I want to start today with a very simple observation. That observation is that the reality of George Washington is not the reality of George Washington's slaves. The reality of George Washington is not the reality of George Washington's slaves. That becomes critically important as we move down toward accepting a whole new era in debate, because it has to inform the way we begin to go about doing what we're doing. What do I mean? For instance, if I wanted to construct a discipline called George Washington, there's a whole universe of data I could select from. We know that George Washington was the father of the country. We know that he was the first commander-in-chief. We know that he has a reputation for truthfulness with the cherry trees and the rest of that stuff. So that if I wanted to construct a discipline that I call George Washington, then in fact I could aggregate all those facts and we could study it and we'd come out with a view of George Washington. And that's largely what we do, by the way. And I want to point that out because the point I'm making here is that that is not an accidental or neutral exercise. That is a purposeful exercise. Now, on the other hand, if I wanted to talk about George Washington from the perspective of George Washington's slaves, those things become relatively unimportant to me. The first thing that I'm aware of is that George Washington was a slave owner, and that's going to color my perception of George Washington. Other things about George Washington, the fact that George Washington owned a string of poorhouses up and down the East Coast, that becomes important to me because I understand the hypocrisy of this trustworthiness thing the same way I understand the hypocrisy of being the father of the country and owning slaves. And finally, when I construct this discipline about George Washington, what I'm going to talk about is the slow and painful death he died of syphilis. Because that seems to me to be the chickens coming home to roost. So you see, we can be in the same place, and we can see the same thing, but our realities are not the same. The reality of George Washington is not the reality of George Washington's slaves. That plays itself out throughout the history of this country and its relationship with people of color. Constitution, I pick it up, and you tell me that this Constitution embodies all the freedoms and liberties that free man has ever espoused in the history of the world. It is the most perfect document in the history of the planet. But from my perspective, from the perspective of George Washington's slaves, you got a problem with your Constitution. I know that when the Constitution was written, the number one domestic problem in this country was, what do you do with the slaves? What do you do with people like me? Yet when I read this Constitution, there's not a single thing in here about me or my problem. Pull your Constitution out, read it, and find that place in the Constitution where it talks about what we're going to do with the slaves. If you're very, very careful, you'll run into that place where they talk about the Three-Fifths Compromise. And then they don't even address me. They call me and other people. And other people. As I read the literature, it becomes clear to me that from the perspective of folks who adore the Constitution, some compromises were necessary. That this discussion about slavery could possibly torpedo the compromise that was necessary to put this Constitution in place. And as a consequence of that, we decided we're going to soft pedal this whole issue. So I can understand that from that perspective. But you have to understand, my reality tells me that at a point in history at which my plight should have been discussed and should have been central to the discussion, I got slighted because we need to make this compromise. So when you talk about your Constitution, the first thing that occurs to me is the extent to which I was left out of it, even though that I was central to that domestic problem. Emancipation Proclamation. And I ask this all the time in class. What did the Emancipation Proclamation do? Free the slave. Strange. I read it. I challenge you to read it. And after you read it, I want to see how anybody in their right mind can figure that document freed any slave. But all the black children all over America are taught that the Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves. Not from my perspective. Here's what it says. It says, if you are a state that is at war against the United States, and you own slaves, your slaveholding state, if you stop your warlike activity against the United States, then you can keep your slaves. But if you continue to fight against us, we're going to free your slaves. How does that free the slaves? And the obvious question becomes, if the Emancipation Proclamation frees the slaves, then what's this 13th Amendment for? So I became curious because I began to look at these questions from the perspective of the slaves, and it doesn't make sense. But see, for the dominant society, it doesn't have to make sense. But from the perspective of George Washington's slaves, that's a problem. As is this whole issue of the 40 acres and a mule. So people are quick to say, well, there's never any real policy about 40 acres and a mule. Let me tell you, that's a very serious conversation. And I recall reading a dialogue where people were talking about, well, people just got out of slavery. It would be inhumane not to do something for these people who have been enslaved all these years. So what we're going to do is we're going to find some land for these folks. We're going to give them the tools to develop the stuff. We're going to let them evolve and develop as any people in America ought to be able to do. But somewhere this 40 acres and a mule thing got lost. And as I read through the manuscripts and the proceedings of the various committees, it turns out that people pretty much agreed that it was the right thing to do. But what they couldn't agree on was, where should the land come from? Well, let's give them that. Well, no, we can't give them that, but that's good land. Well, we can't give them that piece because there's a river going through there. We might need that. It echoes the same kinds of decisions that were made in South Africa when the apartheid government decided that they were going to seize the land and put the black populations in South Africa on the little rocks where you can't grow anything. Resettlement policy. From the perspective of George Washington's slaves, it's different. Brown versus the Board of Education. And this is the one where you told me that we're going to resolve these problems because now we're going to do away with segregation. I read the 1954 decision and I am horrified. I am horrified Because what you tell me in 1954 is that my child can't get an education that's worth anything unless he's sitting next to a child that's white. Can you imagine the impact that has on somebody who is looking, thinking that this is supposed to operate in my behalf? And you tell me that one of the intangibles here that is, it's necessary for a black child to be in the proximity of a white child to get an adequate education. Now, from the perspective of George Washington, that 1954 decision might have been a step forward. To me, it's an insult. And just in case somebody missed the point, there is no way in which I need a white person sitting next to me to have an adequate education. I taught in black schools all my life, and if there's any child who sat in there who thought they needed a white child next to them in order to receive an adequate education, they were not paying attention. And you go back and you comb through that literature, and you'll find that nowhere in there does it say that a white child needs a black child next to them to have an adequate education. So what you give me in 54 doesn't cut it. And then in 55, you infuriate me. Because in 1955, you come out with this all deliberate speed doctrine. Well, what the hell does all deliberate speed mean? It means that even though we recognize that you are being harmed, that you're being injured by this situation, we don't want to move too fast in correcting your situation, because if we do, it might destabilize those folks who are victimizing you. American jurisprudence. You understand what I'm saying? It says, these folks got you by the throat, you come through the courts, you've fought this battle out, and now we're at the point where we recognize the fact that you are being victimized. But don't ask them to stop choking you right now, because it might upset them. And this is Brown versus the Board that I'm supposed to pledge allegiance to. Not from my perspective. Even if you go, and I'll end this shortly, because we could spend the rest of the day doing this. Let's talk about free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty I'm free at last. As a matter of fact, I started thinking Tuna was going to go Martin Luther King on me for a minute there. And I really like the way in which that came up. Think about this. What you need to know about the March on Washington is that when it was originally designed, the purpose was to stop the U.S. government. That this mechanism, which is grinding out death and destruction all over the globe, there had come together some organizations who decided, we need to stop this. We're going to put so many people in the streets in D.C., we're going to halt all of that. We're going to cause it to halt, simply by the press of our bodies. People in this country who understood what was going on, we're going to all get up there and we're going to make people stop this stuff. But it was being organized by Malcolm X and some others. Now, turns out that the government, as they always do, found out about the plans and made some very serious attempts to change the nature of it. When they couldn't get it stopped, they decided, okay, we will change the nature of the march. And that's when King was brought in. And that's when it became a celebration of our freedom. And as I sat and I watched the speech where King said, free at last, free at last, in my mind, I'm thinking there must be white people all over America going, Mabel, they're free. How do you feel? And Mabel would check her. Well, you know, I feel all right about this. You know, I don't feel measurably different than I did yesterday. So maybe this freedom for them is all right. But see, what I'm thinking is, before that march on Washington, the hallmark in the streets of America was liberation. It's a term we don't even use anymore. The term liberation was on everybody's lips. that we are all enslaved, and the only thing that's logical to do when you're enslaved is to get free, to liberate yourself, in the words of Malcolm X, by any means necessary. Very simple. So that freedom that was talked about was something which was non-threatening. I mean, Mabel can go on doing whatever Mabel does for her living, in a very nice kind of fashion. And we don't have to challenge anybody's authority. We don't have to challenge anybody's assumption. Liberation means something much more revolutionary. That word catches in my throat, but we don't use that word anymore either. But in the day, as they say now, liberation revolutionary, revolution were the words. That was before people decided that revolution was a good ad campaign and that you could make very good songs with that term. But people really meant something about that. From the perspective of George Washington's slave, liberation meant something. It meant at last we are going to force this country to live out its creed for everybody. The stuff that they talked about that we always knew we were not a part of, we're going to make them include us in that. We, in fact, are going to knock down those barriers which have kept us over on our particular little piece of this rock. And we're going to join American society, like it or not. Liberation. We either all going to be free or we all going there. Your choice. But one of the things that age will do for you is show you that even when you feel very strongly about changing the world, I think it's to manifest itself, doesn't happen exactly the way you want to, nor does it happen immediately. It's not a sprint. It's a marathon. Now, why do I raise this issue? It's beyond the simple the notion about different realities. It's different even than, you know, you give us Martin Luther King. We get to celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday. And that means that we're all on the same page. No, we still got different realities because you won't let me celebrate Malcolm X. That's who I want. And in the final analysis, you don't even let me know about Martin Luther King's last speech where he said, I tried this nonviolent stuff for a long time and maybe there are other ways we need to do that. You don't even let me hear that one. But it goes beyond that. Again, we exist in the same place, but we're looking at different things. The reality of George Washington is different from the reality of George Washington's slave. Second point, the reality of this country's depressed community, Soros and those folks call it underserved community, is institutional failure, is exploitation, is general hopelessness. As one of the kids in New York put it to me, things just don't work in the hood. Things don't work. Schools don't work. You've been studying this thing. You know schools don't work there. I've seen the studies that say kids in New York come in at a certain level and get dumber every year they're in school. I've seen the data in Atlanta that says kids come in operating at the 70th percentile level on national tests. And that by the time they finish the 12th grade, they're operating at a 30% higher level, and that they go down every single year. We know the schools don't work. Families are not working. For a number of reasons, but you've seen the studies. You know what happens in single-family households that proliferate all over our community. They don't work. Law enforcement doesn't work. And anybody who's been in or around or near minority communities know what law enforcement looks like in those communities. Very upstanding young person like myself, if the police were going to pull me out of my van and put me on the floor in the street with a gun pointed at my head. Me. If that had been Johnny Depp, he'd have shot him. And this is a black law enforcement official because that's how the law enforcement function is seen in our communities. And if we happen to abuse you and you're right, we're sorry, but that's how it is over here because there are other things that we need to get done. That's our perspective. Religion doesn't work. And I know people get upset with me, but there is an anti-intellectual trend in religions in our community, and it says, disregard the fact that our rights are trampled on here, and we're treated without respect because our reward is going somewhere later. Don't worry about what happens here, because we're going to get ours after we die. And in fact, we have a way of even laughing at people who abuse us. And that found its way on TV. I mean, look at JJ, whatever that thing was, where we're poor, we're stuck in this, and we ain't got nothing, but we can laugh at the folks who come to collect rent from us every month. It doesn't work. Healthcare doesn't work. I was at a seminar recently, and one of the things that I found really startling, this guy was talking about particulate matter, and he was saying that there's all kinds of particulate matter in the air in our community. Because we don't have a way to fight anybody off of doing anything in there. But one of the things that I found really strange, and it's probably because I don't know anything about this, they tell me that particulate matter, when it gets to a certain size, will be filtered out by certain stuff in the body. I guess it gets caught in hairs in your nose or something. I'm not sure how that works. But when it gets to a certain point, the particulate matter can get through all of that stuff and will lodge in your organs. And that's when we start dropping like flies. One of the things they pointed out was the nail shops in our community have some sort of chemicals that they use in there that have this particulate matter. So they got this stuff bouncing all over hell in these little nail shops. And now I drive down the community and I see a nail shop every other place. All over the place. I'm looking at them differently. They don't work. Economic development, you know that. When I was in my first path of being a college professor, one of the things I used to enjoy telling students was that in minority communities, the level of unemployment is constantly above depression level unemployment, consistently, every day. And you know what happened to people when we had the depression in the 80s? Folk in three-piece suits jumping off the top of buildings because they lost their money. Depression level unemployment every day in our community. So that I want you to understand that the fact that we exist at the same time, the fact that we say that we're prosperous as a country, does not eliminate the reality that comes from living in these communities. Second thing about these communities, to be vulnerable is to be exploited. Belinda and I were watching a show a couple of days ago. And it's very interesting to me because they followed them. The thing that just ticked us off is it's a 2020 show, and they're talking about what happens to young kids when they get put in a prison environment. And they have a whole prison full of black people. They got 15 new kids coming in, three of whom were white. And when they did the profiles of the folks going into prison, who they profiled? Three white kids and a little bitty, tiny little tidbit at the end about this black homosexual. Now, we were originally just upset about that. How dare they do that? And I think we have to be upset about that, and we're right to be upset about that. But there's a greater irony. Whatever this woman's name is, when she was doing her interview, she went to one of those young guys in the prison. Black guy said, "Isn't it horrible the way these white kids are mistreated in here? It's just sad. They're picked on because they're white." And the guy, who should be a professor or something, said, "Well, ma'am, the way I look at it is 75% of the people in his place are black. So if the white people get picked on, that's majority rule to me." It's so clear. Because, see, that's his reality. Where he comes from, our communities are outnumbered, and if you're outnumbered, that means you're vulnerable. If you're vulnerable, you get exploited. That's why you're going to meet kids here for whom being tough is one of the most important aspects of their life. Because if you're not tough, you're going to get exploited. You're going to see them, and it's going to be important to them to be tough. As a matter of fact, whole communities are less vulnerable. I'm thinking of, again, and I hope Melissa's going to live it, one thing I'm thinking of, but she was from Detroit. And I'm thinking about remembering back to those days when the word was, we're going to change the assembly line in Detroit to make them more efficient. Well, okay, Mr. Rich White Man, how are you going to do this? Well, what we're going to do is, instead of having all of these people on the assembly line, okay, we're going to put a computer over here, and then we're going to put robots at each of these stations. And then we're going to program this computer to make the robots do things. And then the assembly line will produce as many cars as we need in any configuration that we need. We'll even have a parts-making computer that will make the parts that are necessary to plug into these various automobiles. But it's not going to hurt you, because this is going to make you more efficient. Well, what happened? What happened is exactly what you think is going to happen. We laid all of these people off. Folks no longer have jobs. The economy, the personal economy of these families goes to pot. Men begin to beat their women up because they no longer feel secure in their role of bringing in resources. Children begin to despise their fathers. All of these maladies begin to occur because the folk in Detroit wanted to make more money, and they did. But see, I can recall, and that's one of the values of growing old. I can recall back in the 50s when automation came in, and the word was, don't worry about this automation stuff, because what's going to happen is, because we automate, everybody's going to have it easier. We're going to go back to 30-hour work week because we got all of these things. Now, understand something. All of these technological advances are made with government money. Private companies do not do exploration that might not lead to profit. Government takes the risk. That is, you and I pay money into these funds. We take the risk, and then the private companies take those resources and run with them. And what ultimately happened with automation, of course, is we discovered that we can still work the same amount of time, but get more work out of it, which means we make more money. Now, you have an option. On the one hand, we can let you go back to a 30-hour work week and make the same amount of profit that we always been making, or we can keep your work week at 40 hours a week and do this automation thing and make more money. Where do you think they went? And it's not simply because these are minority communities. It's because these are vulnerable communities. I read a number of studies when I was doing criminal justice work that said the number one reason you get to be a victim is because you're vulnerable. People don't go around and say, let me go find some black guy and attack him. They go, let me find somebody who can't defend themselves and attack him. It's part of what we do here. Now, I said hopelessness. And this can be the most pernicious aspect of all of this. There's a section that I was writing for another piece called Adapting to the Death of Hope. Adapting to the death of hope. Hope means, the adapting to the death of hope means you finally come to realize that ain't nothing gonna change here. That nothing is going to change here. That the community the way it is now will be the community the way it is 10 years ago. Nobody's gonna wave a magic wand. It's when you begin to understand that Santa Claus doesn't really operate here. Well, what happened? One of the things we discover happened is high-risk activity becomes rational. We always make critiques of folks, well, they can't defer gratification. Well, what's the point of deferring gratification if all that's going to happen is that you're going to fall prey to all the various and sundry schemes in the community to wipe you out? I mean, what's the point? Why not take it now? Sex is pleasurable. Kid I met in Atlanta told me that African kids, it said this was an African proverb, I don't know if he was lying or not, he could have been. But what he said is, he said, old African proverb in my village says, people have sex because God intended for them to. If not, he would not have made it so pleasurable. Now, compare that with, and nothing good going to happen to me tomorrow. The only thing that's going to happen to me tomorrow is I'm going to fight off more effort than exploitation and destruction. Why not get high? Being high is enjoyable. Why not do it now? Because I may not get a chance to do it later. I talking about 14, 15, 16-year-old kids who knew they would never live to be 20 years old. And when you start talking to them about how well we can do this and that and the other, they can explain it to you in great detail. Now, not here. Well, let's take you out of here. Well, no, because then they'll go get my brother. Or then they'll go get my sister. So when you look at that reality, when you come face to face with that reality, why not go for the high-risk activity if it provides you with a moment of relief or pleasure? So we see high-risk activity all over the city, the area.